Hello and welcome to Misbehave, the podcast where we explore human behavior in a business context. Season 2 of Misbehave is all about uncovering behavioral patterns which create success in life and business. We're joined by highly driven, accomplished individuals to assess their behavioral patterns and dive into how behaviors have influenced their journey. In this episode, we talk with Stephanie Chung, author of Ally Leadership and leader of several major private aviation companies. We talk about everything from the concept of ally leadership and how to lead people not like you, to driving transformation in the right way, to the secret to creating exceptional customer service in high expectation industries. Well, welcome, Stephanie. We are so pleased to have you with us today. Obviously, we are going to get into all things leadership, but I think a good question, let's start with your earlier career and talk us through. You have led several major private aviation companies, which I feel like is quite an unusual job, in high profile roles. So talk to us a little bit about that background and how it brought you to where you are now.
Yeah, so I'll start at the beginning as to how I got there, right? So I always like to give credit where credit is due. I am a Air Force brat. So my dad was in the US Air Force my entire life. So I grew up on active military bases. And what that means is, you know, I moved every 2 years of my life. So that set the groundwork for who I am today and how I lead today as well. And so I grew up hearing planes take off and land every single day because I lived on an active Air Force base. So as a young child, I knew that I wanted to be in aviation. I just didn't know what I could do in aviation because way back in the day, if you were a man, you were a pilot. And if you were a woman, you were a flight attendant. And so me as a child, an African-American child, as a person of color, I didn't see anywhere in film or magazines or movies or anything like that. I'd never seen a person of color depicted as an aviator. So it went beyond, you know, men being a pilot and women being a flight attendant. I just had seen no representation whatsoever for somebody like me who wanted to be in aviation, but really didn't know what I could do in aviation because I'd never seen it depicted before. That said, my very first job, I was parking planes and loading luggage at the Boston Logan Airport. And that was my first job. And I loved that job. So that's how I started in aviation. And then, you know, one of the executives saw me and was like, you know, Steph, every time I come to this airport, I see you with a smile on your face, you're serving customers. I think we have you in the wrong position. I think you should be in sales. Right. And I'm like, okay, you know, I knew nothing about sales. And so I went ahead and sold for the airlines, did a really good job there, then got promoted and then got recruited from the airlines into private aviation. So private aviation, one of the big companies came in and recruited me. And I remember just thinking, you know, I'm a child of a soldier. I didn't grow up around wealth or money. And so I knew nothing about private aviation. I was around fighter planes, but not around private planes, right? And so it was a really big awakening for me, but I absolutely loved the industry and loved the career and the industry has loved me back. And so that's where I've been, you know, in aviation for the past 40 years, whether it was in the airline side or in the private aviation side, primarily in sales roles. And then I was asked to take over a private aviation company, to your point, Laura. And that was a really great experience because that stretched me beyond what I was used to. Because up until that point, I had always been a sales leader. And now all of a sudden, you know, you're leading an entire company. You have to know how to lead finance and HR and the legal department and yes, sales and marketing and customer service. But that really expanded my leadership abilities and how I saw leadership as well. And then from there, to your point, I got recruited into another company where I was part of the team that we took that company public. And so that was just a much bigger level, bigger scale. And the company was much larger as well. And so I learned a lot of lessons during that time. And all it did was ingrain what I already loved about leadership and reinforced it. Because as a child of a soldier, you're around leadership your entire life. You may not necessarily think of it that way, but you're always seeing, you know, cause and effect. You're always seeing different levels of authority. You're always seeing how people are to act and respect at different levels of authority. So as a little girl, leadership was really planted into my head and I got to see it on a daily basis. And that's why I'm now so incredibly passionate about doing my part to make sure that we can help the next tier of leaders really step into it. Because I think leadership is honorable, but I think it's a big responsibility. And I'm a person of faith. And I think that one day, as you know, as a person who has led many people, you know, I think leadership is one of those things that one day I'll be held accountable to how did I do, right? And when you think of the people that you have influence over, it's powerful. And so I always want to use that responsibility or use that privilege really responsibly, I should say. And so, yes, so I've led private jet companies. It's a fun business. It's a sexy business. It's an aspirational business. Everybody wants to aspire to either fly in a private jet or afford a private jet. So it's very aspirational. So it's a different type of industry, but I've had a tremendous amount of fun in the process.
Sounds good.
It does. I think that's really interesting about watching leadership in the military, because I think if you could think about what industry has really obvious signs of leadership, it's in military or armed forces environments. And I think, I know we were talking before around, I think we have a bit of an epidemic currently around so many people have no training or accidental managers and leaders. And so that vision of what good leadership is or what structured leadership looks like is disappearing. But actually in those industries, like it's interesting about you growing up and seeing that, because I think a lot of managers and leaders don't grow up seeing that, because in other industries, it's not that obvious. So you almost don't grow up seeing what leadership actually looks like in practice.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting because it's such a level of respect as well when you're growing up in the military, right? Because like, I let's say if I was a little girl walking, you know, on base with my father holding his hand, it's people are either higher level than him or lower level than him. So as soldiers are passing each other, they're saluting, they're, you know, respectful, they're making eye contact, they're smiling, they're doing a lot of little nuances that is, it may seem like it's small, but you know, let's fast forward. We all lead leaders, right? And we coach leaders and develop leaders. Just getting them to understand their facial expressions when they walk in a meeting, right? That's like, we all know it could take us hours to help them get that, right? Because it's so important. So if you're walking into a meeting and you're coming in thinking about the last meeting you were just in that may have had you frustrated or annoyed or what have you, and you walk into this meeting and your facial expression is mirroring your last meeting, right? You set the entire environment when you walk into this meeting. Now they're all thinking, oh, what's the matter with him? Or what's the matter with her? Or are we in trouble? Or, you know, they seem a little upset. And it has nothing to do with the meeting you just walked into. So facial expressions matter. And so let's fast forward, going back to when I was a little girl, you know, as soldiers are walking, they're making eye contact. They're saluting each other. They're saying, good morning, sir, good morning, ma'am, whatever, right? But those are little nuances that mean a lot in the workforce. And so I saw it at a very granular level, and not just how we think of leadership in a big, you know, titles, teams, departments, budgets, all those are important. But I actually am probably more fixated on the little nuances, because that's where sometimes the most spoken, most powerful words are actually unspoken.
Yeah, for sure. We use this lovely terminology on some of the work that we do. And it's your body's talking so loud, I can't hear what you're saying.
I love that.
And it's often like you know, you walking into a room and it's not just your facial expressions, it's your whole body. And
yes,
people do focus a lot of effort on the verbals, but actually the non-verbals, and if they're not congruent too, you feel off and you feel different. And then it impacts trust levels. And I think it's really important from a leadership standpoint to be conscious. You have to be conscious of both sides. And I do think we've lost some of that, you know, more relaxed culture, that nice environment for people to work in. I think some of the, maybe the small nuances, but also some of the formalities that are important from a leadership standpoint have maybe been forgotten in some areas and some sectors. It's important to remind people of that. And to be fair, it's not just leaders in a room. I think it's body language across the board of everybody bringing their energy into a room.
Exactly. Yeah, and I was just going to say, and you couple that with hybrid work or a lot of work being virtual, and so you're not physically with each other, and so that just adds a different complexity as well. I think that's a very well said, Sarah.
And I think that's what one of the reasons we're so passionate about behavior, isn't it? Because when we look at people's behavioral patterns, is what we would call them, certain behaviors have certain default body languages. So if somebody is really reflective in nature, often they don't give away much at all. And you know, you can be sat around a table, and we often even see it the other way, where managers or leaders misinterpret the signals or the non-signals that their team is giving them. So they might be talking, and if they've got lots of people who are deep in thought, they're maybe detail-oriented, they're just sitting there processing, but they're not giving a lot away. They're not nodding. They're not giving cues that they are getting it or that they're on board with it. And then often the manager feels frustrated. They can feel disengaged. Sometimes they react to those non-reactions. And actually, that's why we're so passionate about teaching the behavioral stuff, so they can understand that actually some of that is they are just processing. It's not that they're deliberately not hearing you or disagreeing with you, but you've just got to give them a moment to process. And vice versa, the people who talk with their hands and talk a lot and their tone is all over the place, as I am, and Sarah's pointing at me. Nobody can see that. Steph, you're the same, I think. And to be fair, you are as well. Sometimes you have to slow that down because not everybody's going to like that. And so it's that awareness, I think, is so interesting.
Well, you know what's really interesting? I know we're talking about leadership, but you know, sales, because I came up in sales and still coach sales as well. That's true in sales. So a lot of times what I always tell salespeople is when your customer is processing, right, their body language may look like, to your point, like they're kind of looking off and they're quiet, and you may see it as they're not buying what you're selling, right? Whereas they're simply trying to process. And so that's your time. I always tell people that's your time to stop talking, stop selling, and give them a minute, because they can't process and think and calculate and listen to you at the same time. Right. So yeah, the same is true for sales, leadership, you know, everybody. So I think that's such a good point.
Yeah, for sure. You're known as a transformational expert. So if you were to describe to the listeners what transformation means to you in the context of leadership, how do you identify when maybe a business is truly ready for that transformational change? When do you know it's the right time?
So one thing I would say, I'll answer it two different ways, right? Because all businesses should be, or all leaders should be, constantly looking to see how can the business be transformed, right? So that they're not stale and or run the risk of being left behind. So when we just think of, you know, businesses moving at such a fast pace that as a collective group, i.e. the leaders or the C-suite or what have you, they should always be looking at how can we be better? How can we be better? How can we be more agile, et cetera? So there's that. That should be never ending, okay? Then there's the leadership side of it, which I would say is true as well. As leaders, we have to constantly be thinking, because it's such a competitive market. And so how do you bring your A game? And how are you making sure that you're leading your team so that they're stepping into their A game as well? Because if you don't do that, you're going to be left behind. So to answer your question, I'm always focused, as a leader, I'm always focused in on, you know, as I'm leading individual people, where is it? What are their gifts and their talents? And where is it that they're really, really good? And how am I continuing to drive that? Now, the flip side is true, because a lot of times what happens is, and again, I'm used to leading sales teams before I started to run companies. So when you think of a sales team and they're the top line, so everybody needs the sales team to win, right? You know, and so when you think of the sales team, a lot of times what leaders do is they will put their attention on the weakest salesperson. So they'll put a lot of energy into the person who's not hitting the number. I don't know that that's the best use of time, right? If they're not hitting the number, you're going to try to set them up and coach them and figure out why they're not hitting the number. And sometimes you've just reached their capacity. It is what it is, right? And so the number still has to get hit. The entire company functions based on the revenue coming in. So with that in mind, I actually am a leader who says you really want to do is spend most of your time with your top performers, because they're probably carrying 80% of your revenue anyway. So the more you can make sure that they're getting to that next level in the little tweaks here and there, and are there blind spots, and, you know, are they just in a season where they're absolutely crushing it, which is great. Like, let's continue to ride that wave. Or maybe they're having a little bit of a stall out. No problem, because you know that that particular performer will take a minute, but then get back right back into it. So I think that leaders have to know, you know, it's easier to, I always say, it's easier to give birth to the new than resurrect the dead, right? So you've got to focus. You've got to focus your energy on where's your biggest return. That may sound a little heartless, but the truth of the matter is that's leadership. We are all in position because we've got a fiscal responsibility. Our board, our stakeholders, our employees, our customers, everybody is expecting the leaders to make good financial decisions. And that includes, do you have the right people in the right seat, on the right bus, going to the right destination? And so that's the part of leadership that a lot of times we don't necessarily talk about. And I think it's super important, especially for the leaders that are up and coming, or maybe this is their first leadership team, et cetera. We've got to get them intellectually mature to understand what leadership is and what it is not. Beyond the title and the money, there you got to make some tough decisions. And you have to be able to not hem and haw and be uncomfortable, you know, making other people uncomfortable, or be the person who's like, oh my gosh, how do I use my voice? Or I don't want people mad at me. That's that. Then don't get in leadership. Just continue to work for somebody else, right? And there's no shame in that, right? Not everybody needs to be a chief, right? So you've got to know what your skill set is and what you're willing to be developed into. And then from there, that should determine, you know, are you focused? Where are you focused? And then how does your leaders help you? So I'm sorry, that was a really long answer, Sarah, to say at the end of the day, how you look at transformation is it should be you're never not looking at it. How does the business have an opportunity to get better, more agile, more streamlined so that it can drive more revenue? And then how can your people, how are you paying attention? A real leader is only focused on developing their people. That's what leadership is, right? We develop leaders. And so how can you constantly be looking at them to figure out where are they good? Where are they struggling? How can I help? And have that conversation with them, because your job is to get them from point A to point B. I would say good leadership is I want to make sure that I have the best people so that all my competitors are constantly trying to come and recruit them. But I've set up a great enough environment because they're being challenged, they're being developed, they're always growing, they have, you know, ongoing communication, that I've set up such an environment that they don't want to go anywhere. So they've got the talent to go someplace, but they choose not to go someplace. Exactly.
And I think that that approach to transformation is interesting, because I think over recent years in particular, and in the wave of digital transformation and all of these different conversations that we're having, and almost the overuse of the word transformation, I think people can associate it with it only being about really huge change projects in organizations. And actually, the fact of the matter is, anytime you change anything, it's a transformation, or that's what you're aiming to do, right? So
yes.
It's how do you think about that more as these small little things that are constantly, they all added together, move the dial forward, but actually we're focused on that always, and we're interested always in how we change for the better, how we evolve, how we bring people on that journey, all of the different things that we're getting out of them in that process.
And what I love about that is that it makes the transformation bite-sized pieces, right? And so if you've got a organization that is constantly just streamlined and focused on how to be better, it's not, to your point, these big, you know, 5-year projects, right? It's just like, how can we get better, you know, 1% every day? And so what it does require, which I think is another point to your question, Sarah, it does require leaders to be leaned in. So you cannot be running all over the place and then you miss the little transformations that are great opportunities. So you have to be so in tuned with your team and your own self-awareness that you're looking for those little things that can actually, when changed or tweaked, can lead to big results. It's not the big things that we pay attention to necessarily.
And that you know how they need to receive change in a way to resonate with it. It's interesting. I did a poll on LinkedIn recently, and I just asked a question of how many businesses, when they roll out change in whatever shape that is, whether that's big or small, think to use any sort of tool to be able to diagnose how people in their business need to receive change. And the vast majority of people said no. that they're, and that blows my mind. And I know that, listen, there's limited resources, there's all of these different things, which is understandable when you're running a busy business. But to me, in businesses that are scaling, that are growing, let's face it, change is just part of your infrastructure. And if you don't know, whatever tool you use, right, if you don't know how those people need to receive change in a way that keeps them engaged and keeps them motivated, that is, it's potentially catastrophic. If you're interested in learning more about your own management behaviors and the behaviors of your team, click the link in the show notes to access a 14-day free trial of Perform. I think that's always the piece that we hear is, you know, we did this change process or we rolled this out, and always during change you have disengagement and you have low morale. And have you got any examples of that from your career working with leaders and managers in different shapes and sizes in the businesses that you've worked in? Examples of where maybe that's gone wrong and actually some of your lessons and how you maintain that morale and that high performance even during periods of change?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I remember one time when I was working for a company, and I wasn't the president at this point. It was just I was on the executive team, and we were doing an entire transformation. It was one of the during the time when there was a big recession going on, and so when recessions are going on, you're in the private jet industry, you get hit really hard, right? And so we were taking the time to go, okay, people are not running and beating down the door to buy jets. And so what can we do with this time while we're in this season? And so we, as an executive team, decided, let's revamp, let's look at the organization, let's figure out how we can use this to transform now the bigger projects because we have a little bit of time. And so what we decided at that point, we were going to become customer centric. And as an organization, we had to have that conversation with ourselves because what we'd realized is we were operational centric, but we weren't necessarily customer centric. And so what was it going to take for us to, you know, flip it on its head, if you will? And so we started out on this long journey, and it was about an 18-month project, but it was a bunch of little things that we were doing step by step by step. And so one of the very first things we had to do was to create a customer ribbon. And basically where you're meeting with every single organization, department, every single person within the department to figure out what are the touch points that you have for the customer. Now, typically what happens in an organization is people tend to think, oh, the customer touch points are customer service, sales, and marketing. Yeah, but actually everybody touches the customer. And so we had to get people, at first, their mindset to shift that, no, you finance also touch the customer. Are our invoices easy to read? Are they on time? Does it make sense? Do people have to look at it and feel like they need a degree from MIT to understand your calculations? Or was it like really clear, right? So what we had to do is get every other department to realize that we all touch the customer. And so now you talk to every employee about what it is that they do from the entry-level job all the way to the leader. And so when we were done with this customer ribbon, and that alone took a long time, and the team and the leaders that put that together did phenomenal. But what we then did is hung it up in the organization, because the first part of it was going to be everybody needed to see it. And then everybody because now you can see yourself in it, right? Most employees want to know, what is it that we do as a company? And how is it that what I do contributes to what we do as a company? It seems super simple, but leaders, if you would just start there, make sure that your people know what business you're in, how does the business make money, and what it is that the purpose of the business. And therefore they can connect the dots about what it is that they do and how it contributes to the overall big picture of the business. So that's one thing that leaders should do. But going back to the customer ribbon, so we put it up in a conference room, and we had to use our biggest conference room in order to put all the papers up and the diagrams up and so on and so forth. And then we had every employee walk through it. And it was like walking through a museum, right? And then they, at the end, you know, we talked to them and as the leadership team, and then they had to sign it, because that's where we were going. This is where we are, and this is where we're going. And so now you can see the role that you play into it. Now, as we're doing that transformation, what that then also determined is not everybody that had the current job should have that current job. Because if you're now becoming customer centric, then, and what we realized is our customer had like five different touch points to just do the simplest of tasks. That's not customer friendly, Right. So how do we now streamline this so that they have one person to talk to and that one person can address the five issues? Well, that's very different, because if you're a person, let's just say in finance, who's not used to talking to people, then I don't know that you're the best person for us to put in customer service, right? And so we're setting you up, we're setting us up, we're setting the customer up, like this is all wrong. So how do we now figure out, do you, even though you don't currently talk to customers, is it because you don't want to talk to customers? We've never asked you to talk to customers. And if we gave you training, could you talk to customers? Some people, yes, some people, no, right? So those are some of the things that we did. And this entire transformation took us 18 months. And because you had to have people re-interview for their jobs, so on and so forth. At the end though, our mission of doing all that was when we came out of this recession, we wanted to be that service provider that every single private flyer felt like, man, these guys are customer centric. I'm going to go there. If I'm not already there, I'm going to go there, because this is the group that really, it's beyond the plane and the all that stuff. It's really about me. Because in the long run, though we're coming out of a recession, we knew that that would allow us to not just attract good, great customers, but retain great customers. And that would drive our renewal rates up, that would drive our new business up, and that would drive our client acquisition down. So that was an example of a time that we did a transformation that was a little bit more robust, but it wasn't us looking at the big, huge picture. It was us going, now we're going to break this organization down into all of its a gazillion parts. And now we're going to fix each little part piece by piece by piece so that we get the bigger result. And it was very, very fruitful.
It's such a brilliant project to focus in on the customer, because often businesses will look at functions rather than the holistic piece around what actually touches the customer and how do they feel about that. And certainly in our business, as a scaling business, we're very conscious about, you know, your pre-conversation, your onboarding, your customer success route, how do you then get them to become advocates of who you are? But that whole journey touches every single member of our team. And how do you then, you know, and as your team grows, it's even more important to have the right people in contact, direct contact with the customer. So I think it's a really brilliant exercise, and it doesn't have to be as onerous as the one that you've just described. Anybody listening can do that kind of exercise. You can do it relatively quick and dirty if it's just a review, depending on the size of the organization, but then focusing in on areas for sure.
And there was two things that came out of that that I thought was really interesting, right? So our maintenance, I remember having a conversation with the maintenance people, because the maintenance guys were like, we don't touch the customer. Oh, really? Right? So help me understand, if a customer's on board the aircraft and the cup holder doesn't work, which is your job, do you think they're going to have a good experience on that flight? Absolutely not. Were they gonna hold their cup the whole time? You know, so those are little things that you now have said, when they start to see that everybody touches the customer. Now, to your point, Sarah, you now have to spend time changing their mindset, because a maintenance person's thinking, it's a broken cup holder. Is it a big deal? Well, we all have cars with cup holders. If the cup holder doesn't work in the car, it's a huge deal, right? So they're thinking the plane still flies. This is ridiculous. Customers don't care. And salespeople are like, this is messing up my negotiations, because you know what? When I go to renew that contract, you know the thing I hear about? The cup holder didn't work, right?
I think that plays into that, especially in that industry, right? In a luxury industry where people have high expectations, because let's face it, they're paying a lot of money. What do you think are from, obviously I know now you work with lots of different types of leaders and managers in different businesses, but in terms of in that luxury high expectation industry, what is the secret to creating exceptional customer success and brand?
Oh, that's such a good question, Laura. So, and it's funny, I still have my foot in aviation, so I'm still very much always having to keep a mindset of the luxury consumer, the high net worth consumer, and what makes them, what's their buying behavior, you know, currently. So, but to answer your question, when you think of people who have, you know, they're the movers and shakers of the economy, is what I always say, right? So they have, money's not the issue. They have the money. But what they don't have, and what you're doing as a luxury provider, is you're trying to figure out, how can I give them an experience that money can't buy? That's the differentiator, right? And so what that means is, now it's not just, any experience, now I have to know you with such a fine-tooth comb that what is the experience that you care about, Mr. High Net Worth or Mrs. High Net Worth, you know, client? And so you have to become so minute and so focused on the customer. I'll give you an example. One of the transformations that I led when I actually was leading the company is we did a similar exercise of what I just shared with you with the customer ribbon. But then what we did is said, okay, now we've hired, you know, the people who now are that one point of contact for the customer. And so let's just say they were customer service reps. What we then did is I was like, let's give them a budget. Because I want now, instead of them being a call center where calls are coming in from all the customers and they have to try to, you know, rely on the system to remember, you know, this customer likes Coca-Cola, this customer likes this. Instead of doing that, we definitely need the system to be able to help them. But I also decided, let's streamline, we're no longer a call center. So depending on where the customer is located, they're going to call into that particular line, and that particular line is answered by people who are covering that region. So now the customer service person doesn't have to try to know thousands of customers. I only need you to know 20. That's all I need you to know, because the way that we've broken up the phones bank, if you will, you're only getting a call from one of these 20 customers. Now, the flip side is, I expect you to know those 20 customers better than you know thyself. So I should be able to come to you and you know everything about this customer, the name of the kids, the birthdays, what their favorite color is, the dog's name. Like, you need to know literally everything. And so when we did that, not only, so now you're giving a budget to, you know, for the most part, entry level, not really entry level, because we actually upgraded the level as well, but still people that you normally don't send customer service folks out on the field, right? You send salespeople out on the field or executives, but usually not customer service. But I was like, no, let's get them out there. They're that customer's one point of contact. And now what ended up happening is we gave them a budget so they would go and visit the customers, because the best way to get to know people, go to their house. Right? House tells you everything, you know? And so now and what ended up happening is we put money towards that. Not only did our customer, our surveys and, you know, again, going back to being customer centric, we were voted number one, you know, private aviation customer, as far as customer experience by customers who fly privately, right? And all of that came back into fruition because we allowed those folks who were answering the phone, who that's their one job, you gotta know these 20 people, we allowed them to go into their atmosphere and now to really get to spend time with them. The second part that was really phenomenal out of that is the budget that we had that we would use to, if a trip went wrong and you had to compensate somebody for the trip or give them a free hour or something like that, that budget dropped because the customer felt like, oh, listen, you know what? I know Sarah did her best. And so if the flight's going to be, you know, an hour delayed, I trust Sarah. Sarah has called me. She's kept me on abreast of what all is going on. And so I don't need you to compensate me for that hour. I know Sarah did the best that she could.
It doesn't become a transactional relationship anymore, does it? It becomes exactly. One built on trust. And then yes. You don't do the tit for tat thing. Whereas when it's transactional, it's like, okay, I've paid X number of dollars for this and I've got this service versus actually I've paid this, but you know what? The full experience has been worth more.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's really where, you know, to answer your question, how you're looking at a luxury consumer is you're not looking at the time that you've got them. So I'm not just looking at their experience once they're on board the aircraft, which is how most people look at it. I'm looking at their experience. Well, we all travel for a living, right? When we travel, we start at home. So we're thinking, okay, I got to pack, what's the weather? And so our experience actually starts in our house. Then it gets into, you know, however we're getting from our house to the airport. And then we get on board the plane. Where most people make a mistake, they're just like, okay, now they're on the board. Now let me track that experience. No. I need to track it from when they leave their house to get ready to try to get to the airport to then get on board my aircraft, you know, so on and so forth. So it's really door-to-door service, not and door meeting, leaving their house until when we get them dropped off to wherever they're going in the city.
And I think that applies to all kinds of businesses, not just the aviation. Like,
yes.
I actually did a business visit the other week, and I had the most exceptional service from the receptionist. She sent me very detailed instructions about how to get in, where my car parking space was. I was greeted by the guy in the entry saying, is it you, Sarah? I was like, yes. And then I came in, I was literally taken through, like the service was impeccable. I arrived in such a good frame of mind for that meeting. And I pointed it out because it's rare. You know, it is rare. Often you're stressed by the time you get there, you can't park, you can't find the meetup, et cetera, et cetera. And I think there's a lot to be said about thinking about the wider contact, not just in situ with you. Really interested to talk about your book. So you wrote a book about ally leadership. Tell us a bit about the concept behind that and why it's so important to you now in the work that you do.
Absolutely. So thank you for that. So Ally Leadership, How to Lead People Who Are Not Like You is the name of the book. And ally is an acronym and it stands for Ask, Listen, Learn, and You Take Action. So it's Ask, Listen, Learn, You Take Action Leadership, right? So that's why I didn't call it allyship. I called it ally leadership, because leaders have to know how to ask, listen, learn, and then take action. So that's the first part. The how to lead people who are not like you. Let's face it. This world is really, we're in such a pivotal, unique, great time if we embrace it the proper way. So I'll talk about here in North America. We've got 5, soon to be 6 generations working. And so that intergenerational stuff is really, really interesting and can be challenging for leaders, because the way that a boomer thinks is not the way that Gen Z, a zoomer thinks, right? They may have different expectations, different perspectives, different work ethics, different wants, different needs. So the intergenerational aspect of the workforce is really interesting these days. Then also we've got women being the majority of the population. And so that changes the dynamics of the workforce, because we think differently, we lead differently, we communicate differently. Then on top of that, you've got the ethnic demographics changing, right? So you've got the ethnic races growing, the non-ethnic race shrinking. So that changes the demographics and the dynamics in the workplace. Then you couple that with, you know, people who have different abilities, right? Or we have different neurodiversities, or we have the LGBTQ plus community. And so what happens is we as leaders are leading a whole lot of people that are not like each other. And they're not necessarily like the leader, right? Yeah, exactly. And so what that means is that we have to figure out how to get this in this new modern workforce, how to still get them to perform at their peak. Now, there's enough research and statistics out there that show the more diverse the team, the better the results, right? So that shouldn't be the discussion anymore. But what we've not really talked about is how do you lead a diverse team, right? People who don't think alike and who aren't the same age and who have different work ethics and, you know, who just see the world differently. How do you as a leader actually get all of that in a way that still allows the company to perform at its maximum? So that's why I wrote the book. But what I also felt like is that the conversation needed to go deeper and wider. So here, at least, you know, I'll talk about here in the States, a lot of times the conversation has been towards men, specifically white men. How do they lead women and people of color? And though that's a good discussion, but it's not the only discussion, right? The rest of the discussion is, well, actually, how do we lead people who are just not like us? And so here, I'll take myself as an example. I'm an African-American woman. I come from I joke like this. I say, you know, my name is Stephanie Chung, right? So I'm a Black woman married to a Japanese guy, and I have a Chinese last name, and I come from an all white male industry. So I've had to learn how to maneuver some stuff, right? but what that really meant was, you know, for me as a Black woman, I remember the one of the very first sales teams I took over in the private jet industry. And I was asked to take over this team. And so I'm standing in front of this all white male team, and I'm looking at them thinking, oh boy, right? And they're looking at me like, where'd she come from? You know, so, how are we going to do this? And because we were not like each other, they, you know, we had literally zero in common. And yet that team was one of the most powerful teams. We were able to use all of our differences in a powerful way. And it started with me having to, you know, extend trust to them and vice versa. They had to trust me as well. And we made something magical. That was really a team that will go down in history in the books of one of the high performing teams. And it was just a team that was really close knit as well. And this was a team that was unstoppable. So the reason why I wrote the book is to really to help leaders like, listen, hey, I've been there and I know what it's like leading people who are not like me. And so that's what I mean by the conversation has to go deeper and wider. It's not just, hey, Mr. White Guy, how do you lead women and people of color and let us, you know, beat you up if you don't get it right. That's not my mission with this book. My mission with the book is to say, if you're a leader and you want to remain relevant and you want to lead today's modern workforce, then I don't care who you are, you're going to be leading people who are not like you. And so the book is a tool on how I've done it successfully and how you can too.
And I think that's amazing. I think that, you know, we still don't have enough conversations around unconscious bias. And I think often when we have these conversations around differences and diversity, and obviously I can speak from, we often talk about women in the workplace because that's something that we've both experienced different struggles with. And there are often when you're having these conversations, there's defensiveness. And more often than it should be, but usually people don't deliberately set out to have a bias. But actually that the title about how to lead people who are not like you, I think is so powerful because you can want to do it, right? You can want to understand someone else's perspective, how somebody's been brought up differently to you, how someone's motivated differently to you. You know, you can want to understand all of that, but unless you acknowledge the fact that you will have some intrinsic unconscious biases that can be as simple as, I think this is the right way to do this and you don't, you're never going to be able to lead the whole host of different people that you're going to be able to interact with.
I totally agree. Yeah, I think that's so powerful, Laura. And one of the things, like in the book, we actually start with the brain science behind it, because you're right, unconscious bias, all the bias, we have a lot of conversations about that, but we don't have a conversation about, well, why is that, right? And so we start with the brain. And when I shared with you all that in the book, there's an assessment that we include in the book people can do. And I encourage people to do it at the beginning before you read the book and then do it again at the end, right? And it's super simple. It's like 10 questions. It's super simple assessment. But I did it with a neurologist. So a neurologist actually helped me create it because I wanted to get into the brain aspect of it. And so when you think about the brain automatically, as you all know, will put people in groups, right? You're either like me, you're not like me. And it's an instinct that there's nothing we can do to override that. It's something that has helped. It's actually, biases aren't necessarily always a bad thing, right? And so it can help, you know, save you time, energy, effort in a lot of different ways. So the brain is a magnificent a piece of equipment, if you will. But the brain will instinctively, when it sees either a picture or somebody, you know, up front in person, it's going to put it in a box because it's just trying to, you know, it's all about conserving energy. So if I feel like you're like me, I'm going to put you in my in group. If I feel like you're not like me, I'm going to put you in my out group. That's where we start. Now, that alone, and that's our default system in our brain. So we can't change that instinct, but we can certainly change the information that we feed it. So then the brain, this is not so instinctively quick to put you in my out box versus my out in group or out group. So there's habits and things that you can do to help override that. And the first thing you do is you ask and you listen and you learn, right? And then you take action. And so asking questions about people and not from a perspective, usually most people don't even know how to ask questions, right? And so because we're asking the question because we want you to confirm what we're thinking. And if we don't, especially as leaders, if we don't feel like you're picking up what we're laying down, we then go into sell, yell, you know, we go into tell, sell, and yell. So we're going to tell you like, okay, I'm not sure that you're getting this. And so we're going to start telling you stuff. And if you feel like they're still not picking it up, then we're going to go into selling you. Well, you know, I mean, here's why this is important, blah, 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 right? If they're still not picking it up, then though we may not yell, our body language, our energy, our facial expressions are kind of like yelling, right? Going, okay, you're not getting it, right? You know? So there's a lot that that basic leadership habits and traits, which are not all good, are doing. And so how do we overcome that? Well, we overcome that by, let's just start with the basics. Instinctively, our brain's going to default and put you either here or there. Now, I can't change that instinct, but I can certainly expand my in-group by asking and listening and learning. That's how I grow as a leader and, quite frankly, as a person. So that's, we start there with the book, because then we can start talking about, you know, the good old boy network and, you know, leading women and how we see things. We can start with all that down the line, but we first have to do first things first. Let's just start with how we are instinctively created. And our brain is powerful and it's magnificent, but there are some areas of it that helped us when we were cavemen, don't necessarily help us now, right? So how do we overcome those things and kind of reprogram it and rewire the brain, which is actually, as we know, quite feasible. We should all be thinking about that all the time. The second part to that, though, is once you understand that, then it becomes, the rest of it becomes easier, because it's not a personal issue, right? Now it's like, oh, okay, well, wait a minute. So this is just a brain thing? Great. Let me figure out how to override that. Yeah. And one of the reasons why this was important is because, as you all know, I speak for a living. And when I speak, a lot of times, actually every time, when I'm done off stage and I'm doing meet and greets, what will inevitably happen is I'll have someone, usually men, who will come up and say, oh, I love it. This is great. I'm such an ally. Like, I'm an ally. I am married to, you know, same woman for 30 years. And we have three girls. Like, I'm a girl dad. Like, I am an ally. Like, bring it on. And my answer to them is always the same. That's fantastic. We need allies. I'm so glad to hear that. Tell me what you've done this week to show your allyship. Crickets, right? They don't have examples of what they've done. And so my whole point in the book and is to let leaders know, or let people know, you cannot call yourself an ally. Somebody else can call you an ally, but you can't call yourself an ally. I can't call myself a nice person. Like, you could say, you know what? I just met Stephanie. She's a nice person. You could say it, but I can't go, you know what? I'm a nice person. Right? Based on what? Right?
So my impression of you, right? Like, that,
yes.
Whether you're an ally, whether you're a nice person, surely that's subjective depending on who says it.
Exactly. And so that's the point behind the book, is I want leaders to realize you can't call yourself an ally. This isn't a participation trophy that you can just go, oh, an ally. We want to see the receipts. And so if you're saying you're an ally in women in the workplace, great. When I say to you, fantastic, tell me what you've done this week to show your allyship, you should be able to rattle off a couple things. What you should not be doing is standing there looking at me cross-eyed because you don't have any examples, right? So in this world today where everybody's BS monitor is on high alert, we want to know receipts. You can't call yourself an ally if you have no receipts. And the way that you, and by the way, if you're an ally, somebody was going to call you that, but they're going to call you that because they see you asking and listening and learning. And more importantly, the most important part, and I'm going to say this for all the people in the back, the most important part that we're paying attention to is the action that you're taking. Are you doing something? Are you saying something? When you see something, are you taking action? Because if we're going to really get raw, that's where people get uncomfortable. And they don't usually take action. Then, so I'll let's say if we're all women here. So if there's, you know, a male leader, a male ally, and you hear somebody get ready to tell a sexist joke, do you get up and walk away because you don't want to participate, which is usually what people do? And then they're proud of themselves because they got up and walked away because they didn't participate. I'm more proud of you if you actually shut that joke down. You walking away doesn't do anything. That's taking action. Exactly. So you could shut the joke down and say, you know what? Actually, I can kind of feel where this joke is going. And I feel like it's going to be disrespectful to women. So if you're okay, I'd rather you not tell it. Or I can leave the table if that would make more sense. That's taking action, right? You getting up and walking away because the joke's still being said. So nobody's giving you brownie points for that. And so that's why this book, you can tell I'm super passionate about it. I tell people this is a book for today's modern leader. You really have, and I'm excited, and I'm not giving you, you know, hypotheticals. I had to go through it, right? I come from an industry where nobody was like me. And so yet I still got to be an officer of a publicly held company. I've reached the highest level, but here's how I did it. And so I write the book and almost as a love letter to leaders, saying, if you want to be a leader worth your salt and you want to remain relevant, and yet you still want to perform and produce really great results for your organization, then you're going to need to know how to lead people who are not like you. And here's a tool on how to do that, in hopes that it helps you do it faster and better.
Well, what a lovely way to wrap up. And for anyone listening, we're going to link the book and Stephanie's website below. So go and look at that. But I think it, you know, it's everything that you said just resonated on so many different levels. And I think leaders now have to acknowledge, we talk a lot, don't we? And we use the phrase that, like, we work with modern workplaces to train their managers, because traditional leadership and management just doesn't cut it anymore. The workplace has changed dramatically from where it was 10, even 5 years ago. You know, if you're a manager or a leader and you're not changing how you're seeing things, you're not constantly going out there and looking at how you can procure those skills and that knowledge, then you're going to be left behind. So thank you so much for joining us. We have loved talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me. This was fun. Best call of the day.
So let's wrap up with some key takeaways from Stephanie's episode. The first really being that taking your time to understand whether you have what it takes and want to do what it takes to be a leader is really important before you take a leadership or management role. And the appreciation that leaders need to make hard and often unpopular decisions. And if you don't want to do that, then maybe that leadership or management role isn't right for you. We also talked about the concept of being able to show receipts and not just pay lip service. And really what we talked about in this takeaway was around the ability to back up what you're saying. So instead of just telling someone, for example, oh, I've got an open door, come and talk to me about anything, being able to evidence the times where you have done that before and being able to really drive that through versus just it being something that you say that often then erodes that trust between managers and their teams. And finally, we talked about the nuances that can come with body language, and that actually to be a really good manager, it is about being able to not just say the right things, but to show in your body language that you mean them, and to be really conscious of how that body language can come across when you're influencing the people around you.
Thank you for listening to Misbehave. Follow us so you don't miss out on other episodes.